Good morning, everyone. Sharmila, I really want to thank you for that absolutely beautiful reading from Whispers, which really just took the essence of the reading from this morning and step by step in one of his poems from Whispers from Eternity. Master writes, I was confined by this body, I was first baptized in this body, and then really talks about the soul's journey until it awakens in freedom and being baptized, and I forget the exact lines, but really in super consciousness, and that just so beautifully paraphrased this reading. Swami, we read every week from this book called Rays of the One Light, and Swami gives us this little reading, little commentary on these readings from the Bible and the Bhagavad Gita. And then there's a book where he expounds a little further, which is called Rays of the Same Light, and he tells us in a little more depth what he sees in these comparison readings. And then he wrote a book called The Promise of Immortality, where he really goes very deeply into the meaning of each of the readings. Many of us have been chagrined for many years because he only did it for the first 6 months of the year. So we're more on our own for the second 6 months. But actually, it's quite a beautiful book. It's available to everybody. But this reading today is the last reading in the second section of that book, Promise of Immortality. And that section is called Instruments of Recognition. And we would have no way of remembering this or knowing it. It's hard to follow week by week. But it always interests me, the path that Swamiji, Swami Kriyananda, takes us on. What's the first reading? And here we are at the 13th reading, where he comes out and says, in no uncertain terms, well, he says many things in this reading, but he says, we are not this ego. We are part of a whole. In fact, the subtitle of this talk in that book is called Imperfection is of the Ego, Perfection is of the Soul. And of course, in the reading, and again, he mentions so many things. You can take each of these readings and pick it up by any thread and give many different talks about the reading. But he says we are a part of a whole, and very clearly, whatever we do to any part of that whole, to anyone, anywhere, we hurt ourselves. Anything negative that we do, even a negative thought, which I'll get to talk about in a little bit, but any action that we take, any thought that we have, a thought being action, where we do anything to anyone, we do it even more intensely to ourselves. And really, he says, it's always the intention of the soul to realize its place in God, but then we're born and the ego just gets in the way over and over. And it has an unending number of ways to do that to us. Yogananda said that he defined yoga in one place as a science whereby the soul utilizes these instruments, utilizes and overcomes the instruments of the mind and the body to attain self-realization. And then he gives this beautiful definition of self-realization as a reawakening consciousness, a reawakening consciousness of the soul's transcendent and immortal nature of being one with God. It's just so beautiful, a definition of self-realization, a reawakening consciousness of the soul's transcendent and immortal nature of being one with God, which really speaks to what Jesus, in this quote from the Bible, is speaking to, that we're all part of a whole. It's so hard to try and get what happens when we're born and the ego takes over. Yesterday I was teaching a class. It was called Death and Dying as a Spiritual Journey. And it was a little bit of a misnomer because everything that happens to us is, of course, part of our spiritual journey, but certainly death and dying are. And I so wanted to be able to tell everybody who was in the class to find a way to share about how much of a dream this life is, how little we really know about what's going on. And I shared with them, and I'm going to share it with you today just because I sort of believed it myself when I said it. So I thought, oh, this is maybe, I've heard it many times, but suddenly it came to me that Yogananda at some point talks to us about a dream. He said, let's imagine that in the dream you are a soldier, you're a general, and you go to battle and you win that battle and you win the next battle and you're feeling so good about yourself in your dream and you're feeling so strong and powerful. And then all of a sudden you go into one battle and you lose and you actually think you're dying. You've been injured and you're dying and you get terrified. And in the dream you're shaking and you feel horrible and you feel great fear that you're losing your life. And then all of a sudden you wake up and you are so relieved that you woke up and you're in your bed and you didn't really win any battles, but hey, you didn't lose and you're not dying either. You're here, you're safe. It was all a dream, even though just minutes ago it felt so real. And he says to us, that is exactly what this life is. You're in the dream, it all feels real. Everything that happened feels real. And very much like in the dream, you pull your guns, you pull your swords, wherever you are, you fight, you do whatever you have to do. He said, but when you die, when you leave, you'll be looking at all of this and you'll realize it was only a dream. But here we are, and that doesn't mean we can take it easy here, because yoga is the science of the soul using this opportunity to attain self-realization, and that's really what we all are trying to do. And what we want to do is to remember that we're part of this whole. I'd like to share a story with you. It's a very personal story, but it's so telling, so appropriate for now. I have a relative in my family who for many, many years I've had just trouble with. I haven't felt that he's treated me well. I could tell the whole story, but suffice it to say it's gone on for a very long time. And for most of the years of my life, it didn't really bother me. I sort of felt, I don't know what the right word is, I could just stay calm in the face of it. But about 2 years ago, for reasons that I'll never know, I got upset about it. And I got angry. And I decided that I was going to write him a letter, and I was going to tell him, you either change your act or we're done. And I wrote the letter, which I decided was a loving letter, because I so lovingly explained everything he had done that was wrong. And I explained it all with this beautiful language that we have. And I showed it to my partner. And my partner said to me, you should not send this letter. And I was indignant, and I wanted to know why. And he said, it's not a good letter. You're not going to get what you think you want. And, of course, I fought with him because I wanted to send this letter, obviously wanting to express a lot of anger. And I rewrote the letter, and it was maybe a shade better. This took a while. And I showed him the letter again. Nope, he said. And the third iteration, I said to him, you're just protecting this person. You're just afraid that if we go to battle, I'm stronger. He said, well, I do feel a little protective of him. He said, but you know, honey, he said, honestly, I feel just as protective of you. He said, this letter really concerns me because it's not you. I've never seen you behave this way. He said, you are somebody who stays as clear and conscious as you can to be coming from a place of love. And he said, I feel such concern for you that if you send this letter, you will hurt yourself way more than you'll hurt him, and you won't get what you want anyway. He said, I know this is hard for you to hear. Hard was not the word. He said, but mostly I'm concerned about you. Well, I will tell you that only by God's grace I listened, because it's not what I felt inside. And, you know, there was my ego, which is what we're talking about in this reading, that wants to speak up for itself, take care of itself, hold on to what it believes, wants to be treated better, show the other person what they're doing wrong. But over the period, and what I wanted to say about that is that if I told that story anywhere, I would be right. That always makes it trickier, doesn't it? When we get to be self-righteously engaged with our ego. The truth is, I was not being treated well. That was the truth. And there were many other truths in there. And boy, I was going to have a heyday with that. But the biggest truth is what Barry said to me. You will hurt yourself really in ways you can't, or not at least in this moment, imagining. You will feel terrible. Well, I rewrote that letter, I don't know how many times, somewhere between 12 and 15 times. And about, this is embarrassing, isn't it? I'm telling you what I was doing with the whole last year of my life. Fortunately, I was doing a few other things. But about 6 weeks ago, the letter came to me. My heart opened, and I held this person in pure love. I really was able to see the divine in them after working with it and praying and taking many other suggestions from Barry about this. Think about it, he said. You always meditate on everything. Talk to God about it. He was just feeding me my own lines. I mean, how could I resist? And the letter came. And it was a letter of love from God to God. God serving God, God loving God. And I showed him the letter, and he said, now this is a beautiful letter. And I sent the letter, and I got a very profound and touching response. And that person and I have subsequently gotten together, and in 3 hours, from a place of deep love and respect, cleared up 20-some years of disharmony. I mean, it was so telling. Whatever you do to any one of mine, you do to yourself in even greater ways, and never mind that, you do it to me also, right out of this reading. The next thing that Swamiji talks about in this reading that really jumps out at you is that it doesn't need to be words or actions. There are many ways to kill something or someone. He says it in his story about the tree, but in the reading, as those escalate, if you have a bad thought, and then he said if you carry that a step further, and even a step further, till he's talking about hellfire, I mean, in the Bible, it's so subtle to realize that it's not simply our overt actions in the world, but it's every thought that we have. You know, in the introduction to Affirmations for Self-Healing, which we read from every week, I'm not going to go into it right now in depth, but you can read it. Swamiji talks so deeply and clearly and beautifully about thoughts and what they mean. And the impressions that they make, the impact that they have. So it's not just the writing of a letter, the getting together with somebody and saying, you are bad. It's all the years of even thinking that, of even self-righteously feeling, I can be with this. I know this isn't about me. It's about them. And it's about them. When we start thinking, I looked this up last night because I didn't know, and I don't have an answer, but various people say we have between 50,000 and 70,000 thoughts per day. And a very, very small percentage of them are positive. So we walk around having all of these thoughts, many of them repeated over and over, completely and totally unaware of the fact that it is having a huge impact on the whole. There's a couple of stories about this. One is from the autobiography of a yogi, as some of you may remember. Yogananda tells it so beautifully. He says, it was dawn. We were in my guru's home, and he was speaking, I forget his exact words, beautiful words, telling just how perfectly Yukteswar was explaining and teaching. And he said, then, like a hypodermic needle in my thigh, comes this mosquito. And he said, so I raised my hand, and he said, just then, I remembered Patanjali's teachings on ahimsa, or nonviolence. He said, so I lowered my hand. But Sri Yukteswar said to him, why don't you just go ahead and finish the deed? And Yogananda said to Yukteswar, are you condoning killing? And he said to him, you've already had the thought. I mean, it's so clear that a thought is no less the action than the action itself. We only think that because so much of it happens in our unconscious mind. Bharat, who's a naturalist who lives up at the village, often tells stories, animal stories from around the world, and stories from books like The Elephant Whisperer and other things like that that he's always reading. And he tells a story about a hunter who was in Zululand. And he was given permission to take down one impala. But he was told by the people there it had to be, it couldn't be one of the male impalas who was with the female herds, because those were, obviously, they needed them to procreate to keep the species alive. He said that if you can find any one impala in a bachelor herd, you can take one down. And the man said to him, they were out all over the place yesterday. All of the bachelor herds were out. But when they went out hunting and they spent all day looking for a bachelor herd, they never found one. He said the male impalas with the females was just out there feeling totally comfortable, exposing itself, because he knew he was safe. He was not allowed to be killed. But the thought was out there that one impala from the bachelor herd could be taken down. They were out of there. And Bharat talks frequently about how often that's the case with animals. He said that's why dogs bite mailmen. Because you have the thought, don't bite the mailman, don't bite the mailman. He said, what the dog hears is, bite the mailman. It bites the mailman. Really just telling us over and over how powerful these thoughts are and how we can't let our thoughts rule us. You know, we don't think about this often, but we are beings who are made up of a causal, an energetic, and a material reality. They're all with us all the time. We don't walk around thinking about that. We think mostly about our material existence. We're trying to decide who we're spending time with in the day, which house we want, what we want for dinner. We're going through all that. We're not remembering that at these much more subtle levels, everything we do is having an impact in the most subtle way. It's making an energetic impression on who we are. That's what's going on in our astral spine. That's what we call the chakras. And then that's how we get our karma. We think things just happen to us. We'd like to believe that we're victims of something or that we are not a part of what's going on. But we've had a thought somewhere. We've done something actually out in the world somewhere that's having some impact on who we are. And we are moving in terms of that subtle energy just as much as we're moving in terms of, in fact, more. It's the thought and the energy behind what's being manifested in our lives that's having us be who we are. So unless we are attuning ourselves at those subtle levels, we will not understand any of what's going on in this world. We will never begin to see how we are now or have in the past created it, or how what we're doing right now is creating what is yet to come. Yesterday in this class on death and dying, there was a young woman, and if she's here today, I hope she can hear this as I thought this was really beautiful, but she came to the class, and I asked everybody at the beginning of the class to say a little bit about just what drew them there, because not everybody's drawn to sit and spend a beautiful Saturday morning talking about death. And I asked them, what brought you here? So everybody said a few words. It was very profound, the level of consciousness, thought and consciousness that brought people there. And it just turned into, because of that, a very lovely class. But this woman said, it just dawned on me that my parents are getting older. I mean, she had that realization. And she said, I'm realizing that I have to think about things like, they're going to die. And how will I help them die? Or how will I help them through an illness? Now, I did say out loud, let's hope that's the order it goes in. I mean, what do we know? But it was a logical way to think about it, that her parents would die before she did. And it was a wonderful reason for her to come to this class. So about 2 hours into the class, I said again, does anybody have any comments or questions? She said again, and this is very understandable and usual when you're trying to grasp deep, these profound spiritual principles. She said, but what do I do? I still don't know what I'm supposed to be doing to get ready to help my parents die. And then she paused and she said, are you telling me that I just have to that's where the emphasis was, keep coming to classes or come to a Sunday service? And I said to her, well, I am saying that, but I said that just that you're trying to just use as a throwaway word, oh, that's all I have to do, is huge. I'm saying that in order to be conscious at the moment that we leave, or to be there consciously for your parents, that you have to begin to watch every single decision that you make in life, every choice that you make, everything, as much as you can. Where you're going to go for dinner, what will the music be like in the restaurant, who will be sitting around you, what friends are you going to spend time with, what books are you going to read moving forward, what movies would you watch, and on, because there's not one single thing that we do in life, nothing, that isn't having an impact on our consciousness and isn't in turn having an impact on the whole of consciousness, because we are all a part of the whole. So whether you have the same religion as your parents or not, whether you know exactly what words to say to them at the moment that they're passing, it won't matter if you've done the best you can do to change your consciousness from ego consciousness to super consciousness. If you've paid attention to what is the goal of life, because then you'll be there, and your very consciousness itself will help them bring their consciousness to where you want them to be. You will be able to give them without thinking about it, without concentrating on it, exactly what it is you want to give them. But we have to pay attention every moment and in every way and understand that there's nothing ever that goes on. When in this reading, when they say every thought that you have will come back to you, because every thought that we have is affecting this whole, of which every one of us is a part. We were a thought, causal. We were energy, astral. And then we were made manifest. I want to finish by sharing with you, there is a friend of Ananda, and I say that because people over decades now have known him. He's a man who's been in prison for most of his adult life for a murder that he did not commit. And many of the ministers and light bearers, I think particularly, but maybe other people from Ananda have gone to see him over the years, because very early on, his mother brought him some books. Autobiography of the Yogi was one of them. He read it, and that was it. He's been 30 years in a federal prison on this path. Now, I went to see him not that long ago. I don't know how many of you have ever been in a federal prison. I've been in them a few times, because once I considered practicing medicine there, one visit said to me, no. There is no light in these prisons. There is no color. There are various shades of gray. Nobody smiles. It's not the point to smile. They are not trying to help people be happy. You are living in a 5x9 cell that's not much taller with another big man. That's your life. I mean, it's incomprehensible to me. It really is. And as I stayed very much in touch with him and tried to think about it, I realize what this man has done with it is exactly what these teachings say. Do with every moment of your life, every action, every thought, every communication, God, God, God. He gives everything to Master, and he asks Master for guidance in everything. You walk into this prison, and he's pure light. He's smiling from the inside out. He has beautiful skin, eating prison food for 30 years. Really, I mean this. It's a miracle. And it's a miracle born of what it means to remember that it is always the soul's intention to find its way back to God. And when you're put in a prison for 30 years and there's not much else to do, you get to do that pretty well, or you die there, if not literally, spiritually. Well, it's coming to me, maybe a little late, but here I am, that really we are in essence in a prison of our own device. Here we are. We imprison ourselves in our minds at a conscious level only, not knowing, not asking of ourselves that we take every opportunity that we can. Bedtime, what am I going to do? Am I going to turn the television on? Or am I going to go and meditate? Will I go to restaurants where there's loud music and they crowd people in? Or will I go to restaurants where the energy's a little more uplifted? Who will I spend my time with tonight? What will I do this weekend? As much as we can, whatever is our next step, let's each resolve right now to live more like our friends living in a federal prison, to say now and now and now to watch our thoughts, to watch our actions, to watch every downward pulling activity that we have and say, no, let me not suffer. Let me move closer and closer to that state of bliss, which simply means continuously bringing our energy back to thoughts of God and everything that will take us there.